Gordon Liddy is my muse. In the Tunnel of Love, A Tale of the Cold War. Black Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Holmes Payne on the case. 1. The Third Reich is a low hobby of mine, well behind Wells's time machine and cowboys like Gordon Liddy. So I was in lazy humor when I booked a posh cabin on a ferry out of Helsinki and sailed for my first visit to Germany, 1985. Truth, I was headed deep into Deutschland to visit my colossal baby brother, the Centurion, on guard with our elite armored cavalry at the right flank of the infamous Fulda Gap. Our branch of Paynes are citizen soldiers, the same as Miss Liberty herself. The first Payne in America quit England the same year Lord Protector Cromwell quit his earthly travail for a colony in Hades. Subsequently, the Paynes fit the forests and swamps of the Carolinas for a century of dirt farming, child-making, and pot-shotting at the Okanichis and Susquehannocks. Moving on, there were several Paynes who fit the Frenchers behind Braddock and Washington, more who fit the Redcoats behind Washington, and one who fit the Redcoats again in the retreat from the burning Capitol building in 1812. Yes, remember, the red-coated devils burnt our Capitol, and the President's house, too. So what was this unbalanced Anglophilia? The Black Hawk Indian War had a Buckeye farm boy. The Mexican War had a vagabond who died of cholera, and the Civil War was so crammed with Payne boys on both sides, half of whom called it the War of the Secession. It's impossible to figure. After that, I lose count until the one great-uncle who vanished in the Bella Wood, and of course my own dad landing on Omaha Beach before H-Hour, and my mom, too, the dark-eyed whack at Fort Benning, who dazzled the armor candidates. We Paynes didn't rise in the ranks. We served as junior fodder and went home. None of us current boys did Vietnam. An odd credit to us and a Payne judgment. We didn't have to. We didn't want to. We didn't. Now an armed service is the mightiest Payne our branch ever produced. A 6'7" Paul Bunyan, who is called Bunyan. He's got legs like booster rockets and a bronze-plated chest, an igneous jaw and aquamarine eyes, a soft-spoken tongue, and a brain suited to a counting house. Bunyan's also my baby brother. I named him Bunyan, an eldest brother's privilege. 13 years behind me, with three other big Paynes in between. In truth, my parents have never known how often they must pray to thank God Almighty for visiting them with such luck. Four healthy sons, and then Bunyan, too. He's loving, kind, studious, honorable, naive like spring, and hearty like fall. The Army didn't seem to know what to do with such a throwback specimen. If there were fire, they'd issue him a platoon and a sergeant named Blackwatch and point. When they brought him back down the mountain in a bag, they'd pin a ribbon on the gore and speechify about why we fight. Yet there's only a Cold War out there for our legions, so instead they spied him right out of Fort Benning's OCS as an honorable bricklayer. After searching around in their ratings, they put him where it counts for boys and girls so far from home. The adjutant general's cadre. He became a postman. It was the genius of the morning's build-up to build down to keep the peace. The mail must get through, right? It's why we fight too, right? And what better station for a blue-eyed behemoth who can read, write, pray, count, and shoot than a postal detachment at the frontest of the front lines, toe-to-toe with the Ruskies on the German frontier? When that dreaded black weekday arrives, Saturday or Sunday aren't black. They're holy or bloody. Blackness is prol work. And the Warsaw Pact divisions rev their T-80 engines and punch out NATO like the champ laid low. How philosophical it will be to have ink-stained, stamp-happy Bunyan in the MIA lists. Marcus Aurelius would understand and approve of Bunyan as a postman. You remember him, Marcus Aurelius. He was the last Roman emperor worth remembering, some 18 centuries back. He served his time in Hades, called back then the German quagmire. Maybe you don't remember. Rome was the capital of the world, and its empire stretched from Britain to Palestine, Abyssinia to the Danube. North of the swampy Danube was end-of-the-world trouble, the German quagmire. The German tribes were bloody-minded savages, scary like nightmares, tireless like floods. Marcus Aurelius camped on the Danube and held back the Germans like a log dam. He wasn't all warrior king, however. He'd been educated to philosophize, and he called himself a Stoic. Simply put, Stoics were princely social climbers who philosophized. Accordingly, Marcus Aurelius never wasted his best centurions on the idiot recruits slogging over the sylvan kill zones and sipping cholera. He kept his handsome captains close at hand, perhaps as postmen, to remind him with their fierce obedience that all poor souls are burdened with corpses. No need to abuse the specially beautiful corpses while they're alive. Marcus Aurelius was much on my bookish mind as my ferryboat eased out of Helsinki Harbor. We were bound hard for Mecklenburg Bay at Travemunde, a Baltic port serving Hamburg. It was a Finnish ship, muscular, clean, very fast, on jet engines that parted the Baltic overnight. And it was stocked with muscular, clean, very fast Nordic beauties who do publicly sauna in small towels or not, and do confide in English, grinning English. There's nothing dirty about it to us, you understand. I ogled the Scandinavians, whom I like most all the time. They're fun, even when they're melancholic. They sensibly favor trim houses, sunny weather, lake water. However, like Marcus Aurelius, I kept closest watch on the Germans on board. Too many war stories, too much bloody-handed history, from Rome through the 20th century, all warned me that there must be something mysteriously scary behind the pleasant German mask of Nordic propriety. At smorgasbord dinner that night at sea, I chanced to be sitting at a long table suddenly occupied by polite German voyagers. I say polite because they used utensils, smoked quietly, discussed music and backpacking with passion, and now and again remarked on the excellence of Finnish cuisine, especially the reindeer meat. I eavesdropped sneakily. When one tense lad caught me cocking my ear at a political quip, he asked me auf Deutsch if I was American. I pretended non-comprehension. I speak German well enough, nearly as good as my Russian, equal to the six other European tongues I've picked up. There was a reason the army coddled me and the NSA hired me. Tip Payne has a sad sack blank brain. However, I didn't want those Germans to think I understood or sympathized with a pickle in Deutschland. As supper finished, the serving tables were removed, and dancing began on the center deck space. Old and young patted their stomachs and tramped to the beat. I delayed my exit to ogle more blonde hips. Sometime between a polka and a waltz, while I was lighting my pipe — I smoked a pipe in those days — one of the Germans appeared at my side. She'd caught me listening into her chit-chat earlier and now asked, in broken English, if I was American. I nodded this time. She pointed to the swirling polka. Der Tanz. Wollen Sie tanzen? She paused and guessed, in English, dance me? It was a simple request. Europeans believe in exercise after dining. And being shipboard, this means pandemonium to music. It's not romantic to them, more like folkish calisthenics. I convinced myself that I could further reconnoiter the Germans by dancing with one. But not a polka. We waited for a waltz. It wasn't entirely research. She was attractive, and I was vain after several weeks in Russia being a know-it-all. Her name was Frau Jodl. Jodl. No relation whatever to the ex-field marshal. She said she was a registered nurse returning from 3 years with the Finns in Africa for the Swedish Red Cross. Her story was amazing, and I heard just pieces of it because her English was hilarious. Afrika, der schwarze Kontinent, black continent. Black continent? Where is the Africans? Not. For my own black secretive reasons, I continued to play dumb about German. Frau Jodl's husband was not mentioned. She was in love with Africa and a Dr. Swede, too, who had broken her heart. She was returning home to visit her family before going out to Zimbabwe again to inoculate the fly-covered and doomed. The Euros are wild for Africa. They think it's outer space, and they're cosmonauts. I knew this, so rather than fritter away our time about the famine, I guided her confidences back to Germany and her family. Her hometown was Nuremberg, deep in Bavaria. "You like Bavaria?" she asked. "Den Wein und die Berge?" I wanted more than wine and mountains. I wouldn't go so far as to polka, and I figured she could drink me into the Baltic. So I used romance, the stupid, obvious, insincere ploy that works eventually anywhere. Buxom, strudel crisp, and fair Frau Jodl was a nurse who was used to clumsy men. She was also a Bavarian, accustomed to pretty words and rendezvous. What persuaded her to me was a mystery. She had not heard of my books or movies, was unimpressed by money, had out-traveled me by an astronomical unit, regarded America a greedy kind, in and out of tantrums. More, I danced badly and dressed like a croquet player. Say it was the Baltic moon, a swift passage, and her whim. The three Finnish backpackers who picked us up at the bar might have helped. "Are you Yank?" asked the big redhead in Brit slang. "You're big like Yank blokes." Frau Jodl was amused when I took pity and let the girls use the shower in my stateroom. Frau Jodl and I sat by, sharing schnapps and watching the picture window of a portal. The ship kicked up white water while the pink beauties shed their punker black and emerged from the hot water like buttercups. Finnish schoolgirls are gorgeous and eager for everything. Well, they gauged me, Lord Tip in his mature cabin. Frau Jodl got to play my acquaintance at first, then my sister, and finally the role she liked, my mother. "They are young," she declared. "Du bist es nicht." Meanwhile, I loosed her broken tongue about the fatherland. It wasn't easy, having to pretend to learn the words to ask just as she was using them. Papa saw 5 years' service in the Panzer Grenadiers. After he was wounded the third time, he was a fireman. Her uncles traveled all over Hitler's map. One lost at sea in a U-boat off Ireland, 2 privates lost in the Ukraine, none at Leningrad or Stalingrad. Many other uncles and cousins survived in bad shape. One was now a prosperous apparel manufacturer, and another sold for Audi. No one, to her knowledge, had served in any of the major murder gangs such as the Stormtroopers and their infamous Panzer divisions. Das Reich, Der Führer, Hermann Göring, Totenkopf. Her papa, the ex-grenadier, was about to retire after 40 years in a vineyard. "You know dies Wein?" she asked. "Erst Leitwund." She used the German word, the Gerin, for coolin, and I almost gave myself away when I translated the obvious for Liebfrau milk, quenching. Maybe I did reveal my deception. She talked more and more auf Deutsch after that, not about the dead and buried Third Reich, but about her dreams and the romantic Baltic. "I'm an adventuress," she said slowly in German, testing me. "It's a job where I come from. You Americans think everyone either stays at home with children or goes to an office without children." My trickery undid me in the end. The Finns kept up slangy patter while angling for my spare beds for the night. Finally, they perceived that Frau Jodl was not leaving, and they left. We elders then alternated in the shower and were sacked out as cozily as knots when conquering Yank tricked himself and fell asleep. She, Bavarian nymph, charitable way past my experience, seemed to like me more than my bombast. Worse, I think, she actually sang me a lullaby. There were no shenanigans early the next morning. Frau Jodl pounded off to consult with her traveling companion, Nurse Heidi. I was pleased to meet them both for a properly dressed smorgasbord luncheon. "You're a writer?" Heidi asked. "No." Frau Jodl helped her friend. "He makes a lot of noise, but he's not so tough. Believe me, he's no fascist." Fascist is a very old word from the Latin for a bundle of rods and an axe, a talisman of state authority. It's also fair to say that it's slang for brute. The nurses laughed. I had rationalized my fascist failure at fascism by then and was comforted. "Daughter of a Panzer Grenadier," I argued to me, "mother of one in time. Tip Payne wasn't going to risk creating another grim-eyed soldat for the fatherland. By the time we docked at Travemünde, I was returned to Marcus Aurelius. The good Stoic wrote in his sensible book, Meditations, that a man should love nothing that is not woven in the pattern of his destiny. Relaxed hip, I translated to myself. Germans are just not your style. Gordon Liddy is my muse. In The Tunnel of Love, A Tale of the Cold War, Black Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Holmes Payne on the Case. 2. I had deeper prejudices waiting off stage, but checked them while transferring from ship to German shore. My travel agent had arranged for a huge blue car to meet me on the quay. I don't go where I can't be driven. And it was an expected first lesson in Germanness that, unlike everywhere else I've been on this earth, the driver and car were punctual and obliging. I felt eager for exploring when Frau Jodl's voice surprised me. Herr Payne, aren't you going to say goodbye? I was surprised how quickly the nurses had passed through customs, given that they were nationals returning from Africa. As for me, the officials had treated my bald eagle like a carte blanche, which both pleased and worried me. Herr Payne, Tip, you didn't kiss us goodbye, continued Frau Jodl. Heidi manhandled her giant bag to the ground and asked me of the Mercedes, is this yours? I was nabbed, another getaway in the trash. My choice now was selfish American or showy gentleman. I didn't hesitate and introduced the car, a pet at their pretty feet. Oh, Herr Payne, said Frau Jodl, wunderbar, how kind. She didn't bother with my ruse anymore, telling me in exacting German that they were in a hurry to catch their train at Hamburg, south. But hadn't I said I was going on to Berlin, east, before I wandered my way to Bavaria? I surrendered again. I was their pet, too. Yet my escort duty was short-lived. No supper-time negotiations. Nurse Heidi's mother would be at the train station at Frankfurt, exactly on time. And if Nurse Heidi, a plump fret cadet, wasn't on the train. Ach, Himmel! What would happen? I had no answer, and watched the ladies hop from the car at the Hamburg Bahnhof and flee toward their schedule. I was relieved and figured I didn't actually have to call Frau Jodl next weekend, though she had kissed me farewell non-maternally and said, you're a funny fellow. You should call me. I'll show you Bavaria, and I promise, no more pocus. My driver swirled me through downtown Hamburg so I could glimpse the new architecture. I also wanted to imagine what sci-fi spy guys like Auden, Isherwood, Spender might have seen 60 years before when they'd arrived to burn up their golden youth. Auden's puppy land is gone, as if it was make-believe. The real firestorms arrived with wings in 1943. Hamburg was, and is, home port of IG Farben, once the gunsmith of the Third Reich. The Allied bombers put it to the torch. You might argue this as the way of war, and you'd be right. Then again, our bombing incinerated German children where they hid, regardless of creed. I am not so tough, it's true, and I stared at the canals and park streams we drove by. I was playing make-believe, trying to hear the huddled ghosts still screaming from Mama. I heard only car horns and speed. Yet another truth of the famous phoenix, when it does rise, is that it aims to flap away specters, too. Hamburg is Marshall Plan original. And then we were on the Autobahn and bound for nightfall in Berlin, moving at 150 kilometers an hour and getting past. Until we took off, I had admired the tidy shops, streets, people, and clock towers, all correct and up to the moment. My harder thoughts were these: landscaping by phosphorus bombs, birdseed by President Truman, prosperity by hard work, thrift, luck. These were the good Germans. The guidebook said so. So why did I bear them such hard-hearted prejudices? Because I often brood like a Roman Stoic, and they don't? Because they build cars as good as tanks? Because they believe in schedules like invasions and executions? Because they smile and smile at large Yankee nabobs? Everyone's forgiven them. I've heard it said, except a few million Jews and Russians, maybe more than a few. So I was Tip, who's read the casualty lists, where it asserts that the Third Reich surrendered as unconditionally as carbon. So suspicious. Marcus Aurelius wrote, "Look beneath the surface for the intrinsic value." I was looking. The Federal Republic of Germany is extrinsic, like ingots. I did not want the dull gleam to fool me. What was deep down inside this polite, rushing clock? Gordon Liddy is my muse. In the Tunnel of Love, A Tale of the Cold War. Black Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Holmes Payne on the case. Tip, the croquet player. 3. This deep down inside cliché is my flimflam, what writers call pointing, because I know where I'm headed and you don't. I wrote it when I was tired and much crankier about Germany than I've yet admitted. So, excuses made, I'll get on to the Tunnel of Love. For 3 days, my car zigzagged the northern plain like a plush scout craft. From Berlin, we drove back across to Cologne, Köln, and then south on the Rhine so I could see Remagen. You don't remember if you're under 50 or not related to a Second World War vet, but Remagen was very famous for 10 days in March, 1945. Our army was stalled along the Rhine River, unable to cross because all the bridges were blown, and the Wehrmacht was dug in, apocalyptically, as it turned out, on the opposite shore. That is, all the bridges except one railroad span at Remagen, where their dynamite had failed. Or that's the story. Our First Army's Third Corps' 9th Armored Division blasted its way to River's Edge and captured both ends of the bridge on March 7th. Victory in Europe followed, the American Army pouring into the breach like a tidal wave. It just so happened that my dad's combat engineer company was attached to 3 Corps. On the 10th day, Dad's company was assigned to climb onto the Remagen Bridge and glue it back together after all the barrages and tank crossings. Platoon leader Dad tossed a coin with another platoon leader. The winner platoon got the dry-footed bridge work. The loser had to go down into the Rhine River, mud, to tidy up our pontoon bridges, then being impolitely shelled, rocketed, bombed, and strafed by the desperate Germans. Dad lost the coin toss, and he was standing on the banks of the Rhine when the Remagen Bridge above him failed and shuddered and collapsed, of a sudden, with the winner platoon of engineers on board. I lunched in brand-new Remagen and watched the Rhine, where I might have ended before I began. My thoughts were crankhood. What are the Germans, nuts? Did they think the American army crossed the Atlantic for a bluff? All those men and machines rolled up to the Rhine were going to turn around because the Germans were tough? Ike was going to say, "Oh, my mistake. I guess we're not sincere like you Germans." I also thought, 40 years isn't long enough. I can still hear the coin toss and the shelling, rocketing, bombing, and strafing directed at my dad. My big blue car descended into the rural, undulating, and fairytale Bavaria at Schweinfurt am Main. I said farewell to driver Jurga, who was 18, unctuous, and a furtive doper, and waited at the train station for brother Bunyan. Bunyan was late arriving. Our army works its junior officers scrupulously. I entertained myself by counting our M1 Abrams blockbuster tanks on the rail cars until Bunyan appeared suddenly on foot. "You're here," he announced happily. "I wasn't sure you'd make it. I mean, you're here." He laughed like my baby brother, but he looked quietly ferocious in officer fatigues, that superb commando-style sweater bearing his first lieutenant gold stripes. He was bigger still, and it had only been a year and a half since I'd last seen him at Mother's Christmas. "How do you like it? Not much, huh?" he asked. I said the M1 tanks were amazing. "No, no. The town, Pig's Crossing, that's what we call it." It was a wet day, and Schweinfurt's depot is a commuter pit stop scarred by graffiti. I returned that I was fascinated by all of it, and went on to comment about Berlin and Köln. I also used some German on him to trade language skills. He frowned at this. It's okay. You don't have to, said Bunyan. We don't, you know, need it much. How's that? I asked. Bavarians speak English? Negative, said Bunyan. We just speak American. I soon learned that our army does not encourage its troops to parley auf Deutsch. And though Bunyan could do it fairly well, he'd become all army. This was a clue for my investigation, and I turned it over while we hopped into his low-slung Japanese speedster and reconnoitered the environs. It's called the Tunnel of Love, and Bunyan told me about it as soon as we passed over it. It's right beneath the road, about a kilometer long. You can see it best in winter, he said. The snow melts first over it. We were north of the clean, quaint town, midway between the two bivouacs of our armored cab. East of the road, I saw the larger barracks set back behind a tree line. Behind a stone wall nearby, there was a concrete column topped by a familiar surly eagle with an enchained swastika for a perch. It's the only real swastika I've seen, said Bunyan. They just leave it there. He explained that once upon a time, those stone barracks had headquartered a panzer regiment. Down a ways, west of the road, Bunyan indicated our armored cav brigade headquarters in a flat glen. That was also where a Luftwaffe field used to be, he said, and our guys had moved into the same shabby wooden barracks and converted the old airfield to a tank and a helicopter parking lot. What was instantly important and confounding to me was that tunnel running a kilometer odd between the two bivouacs. The Hitlerites built it for an air raid shelter, an armory. They flooded it when they retreated, Bunyan explained, and we've just left it that way. Too dangerous to go down into because of the unexploded ordnance. Not doable. Bunyan didn't know why it's called the Tunnel of Love. It just is. Der Liebstunnel. There were more clues in what Bunyan said as we spun back through the town to his private digs. Officers live on the economy. I got very suspicious. You use the same barracks? I asked. Sure, said Bunyan. It's cheaper than building. And what the heck? They're built pretty good.
The swastika eagle is left in place?
Yeah, I've wondered about that, said Bunyan. They must have figured it didn't matter. What do you mean, cleaning out the Tunnel of Love is not doable, I asked. Hey, I just got here, he said. But it'd be a mess down there. Who's going to pay for it? What sort of frontline bunker is this, I asked. The frontest, said Bunyan. We're the Black Horse tip. The hostiles are just 40 clicks north. Nothing between us and the gap but speed. He meant the Fulda Gap. The Gap is mythological warrior talk for a future killing field around the farm town of Fulda, to the immediate northwest of Schweinfurt and the Tunnel of Love. The Gap is where our shrewdest war planners have been expecting the Reds, the hostiles, to invade civilization since the Potsdam Conference, summer 1945. Bunyan was telling me that East Germany was an easy drive north, especially in an Abrams M1 jet engine tank at 70 kph. He was also telling me that his armored cavalry regiment, the elite Black Horse, attached to our 8th Infantry Division, was at the right flank of the first day of the end of the world. Shall I repeat this? What sort of frontline bunker was Schweinfurt am Main? The sort at the end of the world on Black Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. Soon enough, we were lounging in Bunyan's flat back in town. I came out of the shower to ask dumb questions about that black weekday to come. Bunyan answered bluntly, "We go into the woods and keep going." I asked which way. Bunyan pointed out his window, over a row house in a park, west toward Philadelphia. "That-a-way," he said. I peered outside. I asked if he meant regroup, fighting withdrawal, last-ditch deployment. Bunyan shrugged. "Geez, Tip, I don't know and don't want to. I do what I'm told and don't think about it." Good sci-fi spy form, I thought. I'm your brother, but you might know what you don't know. You know, so say zip. I pushed him anyway. I said that we've got just half of an armored cav regiment at Fulda, the other half here at Schweinfurt on the right flank. I asked how many divisions the Reds were pushing through the gap. Hey, Bunyan laughed. You ever seen what one armored division looks like when it's coming at you? What we were discussing, with slight order-of-battle facts but with much common sense, was that when World War III's DEFCON 1 sounded a klaxon blast, meaning invasion by hordes momentarily, our guys were to pile onto anything with treads, wheels, or blades and bug out. Schweinfurt is a crater waiting to happen.
Doom incarnate.
I had flattered myself when I'd spotted the nuke plant bubble east of town, and I thought, well, if it's really bad, they can put an arrow into the container building and no one will want the Main River Valley for 100 years. But our army isn't thinking about slow death. Bunyan's armored cav is to get on their black horses and advance backward to Switzerland, because this part of Bavaria is scheduled to be kaput instantly and forever. Look at the map, where East Germany sticks a knee into West Germany's belly. Belly button Fulda, to the northwest of Schweinfurt, is a sleepy town on the sleepy Fulda River, anchoring a gap in the hills between the Fulda and Main rivers, which actually becomes an armor autobahn. The Main River Valley takes your normal red T-80 driver zigzagging straight to the Rhine, where some red guys turn south for Spain, and other red guys turn northwest for London. I understood right then what's said to be between the Cold War and Comrade Sheriff of Nottingham is this exquisite rolling tank country of North Bavaria, where the farmers outproduce nature and the wine is quenching. NATO's muscle, shape, back at Brussels, isn't going to wait for a fighting withdrawal back to the Rhine while the good guys mobilize Frenchers and Brits and resupply from America by container ship. Forget that World War III sci-fi spy charade in the books. How we'll have 8 days of warning time while the Reds concentrate their divisions. How we'll have 10 days to slow them down before we have to go nuke. On the first day, in the first hour, the brass is going to sigh, maybe tell Washington, if the satellites still work, sigh again and then make Bavaria and Hesse a moonscape with some gigantic weapons, which, for no reason, don't scare voters because they are called conventional. The tiny, tiny nuclear ones aren't going to be used at first, not because of faint-hearted taboo, but because, like gas and germs, they tend to drift the poison back on you willy-nilly. By the end of that first black weekday, however, the tiny, tiny nukes are going to seem a mercy killing compared to the conventional cloudbursts. On that first day, Bunyan will be going backward, not from their rangefinders and smart bomb lock-ons, but from ours. Tom Clancy and Larry Bond, my admired mentors, listen up. No counterattacks, nifty stealth takeouts, Custer 2 last stands. Here's the actual battle scenario. Black weekday, bug out, the end. I overenjoyed this bleak vision that night at dinner with Bunyan. I was picturing myself moving from one prearranged fire coordinate to the next, as we spun through the farm fields to a potato soup restaurant, and then back to his digs. I'm usually excited whenever at futuristic ground zeros. Empire State Building, Capitol Dome, Eiffel Tower, Pantheon, Kremlin. But to be inside a future former river valley is my kind of appalling fascination. I'll make a note here for the strategic treason discovered since my visit to Bavaria. It's alleged that one of our sergeants, a guy my age, sold out the 8th Division's escape plans to the Reds. Units, routes, coordinates, life expectancies. Sold them out not for politics, but for cash and hormones. If true, then my dear Bunyan was one of those boys you sold out, Sarge, and I have a private vengeance and long memory. If true, freeze in Hades, Sarge. That evening, none of my fancy patter bothered Bunyan. He knew his big brother was always making believe. Then he changed tones and told me that he didn't really comprehend the Germans. They were pleasant, but not friendly. Happy to take his marks, but unhappy about his uniform, his professionalism, his fact. He had the best time when, on days off, he dressed civvy and drove down into Bavaria, away from our bivouacs. "They don't like us," he summated flatly. "We spend a lot of money, and they don't like us. No fraternization." I asked if the demimondanes were accepted. "They're mostly Americans, too." "Certainly the German army," I tried, de Lansfair, "must appreciate what we're doing here." "Nope," he said. "They're crummy soldiers. Just look at them. Good cadres, bad recruits. It's involuntary for them, and they hate it. Drugs and stuff." I listened and speculated. I think I even dreamed about the tunnel of love that first night. Then again, being buried alive is called a nightmare. I was trying to put Der Liebstunnel together with what I'd seen of arisen Germany and fancied about our bug-out war plans. The tunnel didn't fit, and neither did the lone swastika eagle and the local antipathy to our boys. Weren't we here defending Germany from the Reds? Perhaps gratitude was overmuch, but tolerance required more than taking your money and grinning. So? Why hadn't we taken down the swastika eagle and cleaned out the tunnel of love? Why were we here until we were needed and then bug out? And then, what to make of this astounding opinion from Straight Arrow Bunyan that the Landswehr was crummy? Germans? Bad soldiers? Mostly, though, my curiosity was fantastic, since it was my intuition that the mystery about the new Germany could only be solved irrationally. This palaver isn't trickery. I truly didn't know then. Look beneath the surface, whispered Marcus Aurelius, for the intrinsic value. Okay, Emperor, I responded. What was in the tunnel of love? Gordon Liddy is my muse. In the Tunnel of Love, A Tale of the Cold War. Black Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Holmes Payne on the case. Tip, the croquet player. 4. Bunyan had to leave me the next morning for an officer's call at 8th Division, HQ, back at Frankfurt. He was apologetic about my having to spend the weekend alone, but this was monthly duty. Well, the brass likes it, he explained. We sit at long tables, and then there's dancing. I think they're trying to be like the British. You know, a spree. Those regimental messes, pass the brandy with expensive cigars. We don't do it very well. We like beer and rock, and hardly anybody smokes. I packed him off and went for breakfast in town. I was content to wander around, send cards to Mom and Dad and my other brothers, maybe take in Hollywood auf Deutsch. Also, there was Frau Jodl at Nuremberg. That sunny, easy day in clean, quaint Schweinfurt led to a grim but incomplete discovery about the tunnel of love. Tip had forgotten, until Bunyan mumbled it on our driving tour, that Schweinfurt, Pig's Crossing, was where the Third Reich's ball-bearing factories had been. That the Allied Air Forces had pounded it flat once upon a time. I thought nothing more of ball bearings until I wandered into a beautiful bookstore after lunch. I spotted several glossy volumes with B-17 pinups on their dust jackets. Schweinfurt, I read quickly, had suffered a black weekday once already. It's still called Black Tuesday hereabouts, summer 1943, when our flying fortresses came in a V of Vs and did murder. You might recall that black weekday if you've ever seen Clark Gable, Walter Pigeon, Van Johnson, Brian Dunleavy, and Edward Arnold in a black-and-white flick called Command Decision, 1949. It's a claustrophobic movie, all reaction shots of the strain of command, but it bites harder when you accept that it's based upon a genuine event. The plot was sci-fi spy. Our 8th Air Force convinced itself that it could shorten the war by sacrificing hundreds of our flying children in order to destroy the Third Reich's ball-bearing factories at Schweinfurt am Main. I recall now that the first four times I saw Command Decision as a kid, it made sense to me. Shorten the war, maximum effort, pound the Nazis, bite your mustache, Clark, attack. And when the first day's recon photos show the target was surrounded, not buried, go back again, rubble the rubble. When I was an older kid, the 1972 Christmas bombing of Hanoi Haiphong Harbor, RB-52s pounding peasants hiding in concrete baskets, alerted me that strategic bombing isn't sage tactics. The next four times I saw Clark Gable wincing as yet another B-17 crash-landed in England, or Walter Pigeon calculating losses by not trying to count aloud with his fingers times 10, it occurred to me slowly that, well, World War II was different, that is, the peacenik line. Sacrifice meant something then. Terror bombing was proper for devils who worship genocide. That bright Friday in Schweinfurt, sashaying along the serene Bavarian cobblestone square, admiring the exquisite barometers in the windows and sipping sumptuous beer, it finally came to me that I had missed the dark joke of that movie all these years. More, since it was loosely based upon fact, the double strike air raids against Regensburg and Schweinfurt on Tuesday, August 17, 1943. I had also missed the weird proposition in the 8th Air Force's daring. Fly 600 bombers naked behind fighter cover to bomb fairytale Bavaria? For ball bearings? To shorten the war? What? I detoured back down to the train depot to inspect where the factories had been. I found there was still a plant there. It made machine tools now, and it looked solidly built on stone foundations, efficiently sited across from the rail lines. I stepped back and considered how unusually flat the railroad and factory compound were. Bavaria rolled. This was potato pancake. I stared at the stone foundations and fancied I could see where the old stone met the new. The pictures in the glossy books were no help figuring what happened. They were mostly snapshots of craters filled with craters, and many numb civilians trying to remember they were breathing. Command decision is the Hollywood version of the story from our side. I was now standing on their side. I studied the high sky and tried to hear the B-17 engines in geometric combat boxes at 24, 25, and 26,000 feet. See the dust balls of flak. Imagine what I would look like through a bomb sight. Ball bearings? Who's kidding? It was summer 1943. The Russians had thrown the Nazis back at Stalingrad. The British had thrown the Nazis back at El Alamein. Our guys were driving across North Africa. Yes, the war was millions of casualties short of finish, but ball bearings? That's esoteric sci-fi spy, same as targeting the nail makers to get at that king, amount his charger. All our brave children dead or missing from methyl marbles? I couldn't figure it. General Curtis LeMay led that first Black Tuesday raid, a strange dark hero who would go on to fight the Cold War with Sack and consternate common sense by running on George Wallace's ticket in 1968. I wondered, in my Bavarian consternation, if there was explanation with tough, brave, self-sacrificing, ruthless, and finally wrong-headed LeMay. Did we do it because we wanted to show we could be wrong-headed? Not for ball bearings, but because we wanted to show that even when we were wrong-headed, there was nowhere to hide. That America, right or wrong, could and would heave machinery and men like spittle until we won. At the same time, the tunnel of love did make better sense to me now. I had thought it an extravagant, extraneous air raid shelter, built with slave labor and fitted out with linoleum, Bauhaus chairs, chandeliers, among the ordnance pyramids and stripped-down Messerschmitts. Now I understood it had been the local Führer bunker, the only safe place during those black weekdays when the earth moved upward. For that first Black Tuesday had been followed that fall of 1943 and several times in 1944 with many more black weekdays of combat boxes of B-17s, B-24s, B-26s, Lancasters. Our side didn't just goose-pig crossing one summer day. We came back and back to stamp out its goose steps. I wondered who got privileges in the Tunnel of Love. The Panzer Regiment would have been in Russia. Could there have been enough Luftwaffe families to fill a kilometer? No. The civilians must have had lifeboat access, VIPs first and last, many children. Okay, I thought, out there in modern Bavaria were many 40-ish farmers who had vivid memories of horrible days in a strange chamber while the bombs fell. Der Liebstunnel had been a nightmare, I reasoned, now mostly gone. My dark thoughts returned to me. On our side, why had America launched bombers at Schweinfurt? On their side, why was Der Liebstunnel still intact? The mystery of it. If our army didn't care for the grimy labor, why hadn't the now prosperous Chamber of Commerce cleaned it up? West Germany had remanufactured itself, dug up each unexploded bomb, no matter the danger, melted down every 88, rebuilt cities in place with the curator's meticulousness when possible. Schweinfurt's town hall bragged about its age. Nothing was to have been left of the Third Reich. Their not-doable Liebstunnel was either an inexplicable freak or a bone-rattling clue. Gordon Liddy is my muse. In the Tunnel of Love, a tale of the Cold War. Black Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Holmes Payne on the case. Tip, the croquet player. 4. Bunyan had to leave me the next morning for an officer's call at 8th Division, HQ, back at Frankfurt.
He was apologetic about my having to spend the weekend alone, but this was monthly duty.
"Well, the brass likes it," he explained. "We sit at long tables, and then there's dancing. I think they're trying to be like the British. You know, esprit. Those regimental messes, pass the brandy with expensive cigars. We don't do it very well. We like beer and rock, and hardly anybody smokes."
I packed him off and went for breakfast in town. I was content to wander around, send cards to Mom and Dad and my other brothers, maybe take in Hollywood auf Deutsch. Also, there was Frau Jodl at Nuremberg. That sunny, easy day in clean, quaint Schweinfurt led to a grim but incomplete discovery about the Tunnel of Love. Tip had forgotten, until Bunyan mumbled it on our driving tour, that Schweinfurt, Pig's Crossing, was where the Third Reich's ball-bearing factories had been. That the Allied Air Forces had pounded it flat once upon a time. I thought nothing more of ball-bearings until I wandered into a beautiful bookstore after lunch. I spotted several glossy volumes with B-17 pin-ups on their dust jackets. Schweinfurt, I read quickly, had suffered a black weekday once already. It's still called Black Tuesday hereabouts, summer 1943, when our flying fortresses came in a V of V's and did murder. You might recall that black weekday if you've ever seen Clark Gable, Walter Pidgeon, Van Johnson, Brian Dunleavy, and Edward Arnold in a black-and-white flick called Command Decision, 1949. It's a claustrophobic movie, all reaction shots of the strain of command, but it bites harder when you accept that it's based upon a genuine event. The plot was sci-fi spy. Our 8th Air Force convinced itself that it could shorten the war by sacrificing hundreds of our flying children in order to destroy the Third Reich's ball-bearing factories at Schweinfurt am Main. I recall now that the first four times I saw Command Decision as a kid, it made sense to me. Shorten the war, maximum effort, pound the Nazis, bite your mustache, Clark, attack. And when the first day's recon photos show the target was surrounded, not buried, go back again, rubble the rubble. When I was an older kid, the 1972 Christmas bombing of Hanoi Haiphong Harbor, our B-52s pounding peasants hiding in concrete baskets, alerted me that strategic bombing isn't sage tactics. The next four times I saw Clark Gable wincing as yet another B-17 crash landed in England, or Walter Pidgeon calculating losses by not trying to count aloud with his fingers times 10, it occurred to me slowly that, well, World War II was different, that is, the peacenik line. Sacrifice meant something then. Terror bombing was proper for devils who worship genocide. That bright Friday in Schweinfurt, sashaying along the serene Bavarian cobblestone square, admiring the exquisite barometers in the windows and sipping sumptuous beer, it finally came to me that I had missed the dark joke of that movie all these years. More, since it was loosely based upon fact, the double-strike air raids against Regensburg and Schweinfurt on Tuesday, August 17, 1943, I had also missed the weird proposition in the 8th Air Force's daring. Fly 600 bombers naked beyond fighter cover to bomb fairytale Bavaria? For ball bearings? To shorten the war? What? I detoured back down to the train depot to inspect where the factories had been. I found there was still a plant there. It made machine tools now, and it looked solidly built on stone foundations, efficiently sited across from the rail lines. I stepped back and considered how unusually flat the railroad and factory compound were. Bavaria rolled. This was potato pancake. I stared at the stone foundations and fancied I could see where the old stone met the new. The pictures in the glossy books were no help figuring what happened. They were mostly snapshots of craters filled with craters, and many numb civilians trying to remember they were breathing. Command Decision is the Hollywood version of the story from our side. I was now standing on their side. I studied the high sky and tried to hear the B-17 engines in geometric combat boxes at 24, 25, and 26,000 feet. See the dust balls of flak. Imagine what I would look like through a bomb sight. Ball bearings? Who's kidding? It was summer 1943. The Russians had thrown the Nazis back at Stalingrad. The British had thrown the Nazis back at El Alamein. Our guys were driving across North Africa. Yes, the war was millions of casualties short of finish, but ball bearings? That's esoteric sci-fi spy, same as targeting the nail makers to get at that king, amount his charger. All our brave children dead or missing from metal marbles? I couldn't figure it. General Curtis LeMay led that first Black Tuesday raid, a strange dark hero who would go on to fight the Cold War with Sack and consternate common sense by running on George Wallace's ticket in 1968. I wondered, in my Bavarian consternation, if there was explanation with tough, brave, self-sacrificing, ruthless, and finally wrong-headed LeMay. Did we do it because we wanted to show we could be wrong-headed? Not for ball bearings, but because we wanted to show that even when we were wrong-headed, there was nowhere to hide. That America, right or wrong, could and would heave machinery and men like spittle until we won. At the same time, the tunnel of love did make better sense to me now. I had thought it an extravagant, extraneous air raid shelter, built with slave labor and fitted out with linoleum, Bauhaus chairs, chandeliers, among the ordnance pyramids and stripped-down Messerschmitts. Now I understood it had been the local Führer bunker, the only safe place during those black weekdays when the earth moved upward. For that first Black Tuesday had been followed that fall of 1943 and several times in 1944 with many more black weekdays of combat boxes of B-17s, B-24s, B-26s, Lancasters. Our side didn't just goose-pig crossing one summer day. We came back and back to stamp out its goose steps. I wondered who got privileges in the Tunnel of Love. The Panzer Regiment would have been in Russia. Could there have been enough Luftwaffe families to fill a kilometer? No. The civilians must have had lifeboat access, VIPs first and last, many children. Okay, I thought, out there in modern Bavaria were many 40-ish farmers who had vivid memories of horrible days in a strange chamber while the bombs fell. Der Liebstunnel had been a nightmare, I reasoned, now mostly gone. My dark thoughts returned to me. On our side, why had America launched bombers at Schweinfurt? On their side, why was Der Liebstunnel still intact? The mystery of it. If our army didn't care for the grimy labor, why hadn't the now prosperous Chamber of Commerce cleaned it up? West Germany had remanufactured itself, dug up each unexploded bomb, no matter the danger, melted down every 88, rebuilt cities in place with the curator's meticulousness when possible. Schweinfurt's town hall bragged about its age. Nothing was to have been left of the Third Reich. Der not-doable Liebstunnel was either an inexplicable freak or a bone-rattling clue. Gordon Liddy is my muse. In the Tunnel of Love, a tale of the Cold War. Black Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Holmes Payne on the case. Tip, the croquet player. 5. Yes, this is a mystery yarn about Germany. Don't take notes. All the clues are coming back. And in sense around. I've shelled, rocketed, bombed, and strafed you with details because I'm fighting back. And my adversary is what's in that tunnel of love. It was important to me to find out. And if it's not to you, maybe I haven't told enough jokes so far. Maybe also I'm carried away by Marcus Aurelius's recommendation to dig, dig, dig for the intrinsic values, to solve the case with overheated words rather than the fire that has never worked permanently. I rang Frau Jodl that evening after watching Eddie Murphy in Beverly Hills in German. Made me feel homesick for silliness. We chatted entirely in colloquial German about my serendipitous week, and she actually said, "Jawohl, Herr Payne," when I hinted at her driving up from Nuremberg and showing me the Bavarian hinterland. She arrived Saturday at exactly 9 a.m. in a maroon Audi that clashed with her coloring. "My uncle's car," she announced. "He's trying to bribe me with one if I don't go back to Africa. My mother's put him up to it. What a deal." Frau Jodl was a brisk flaxen head, with big shoulders, many curves, and pale blue skin that must have harried her in Africa. That day she wore climbing tweeds, and I soon discovered why.
we darted up the splendid Cupcake Hills to the foot of a famous brewery monastery, Kreuzberg Rhone. The tourist buses up from Munich certified that this was what Bavarians considered weekend glee. We climbed up to the holy Gothic masonry. I balked at the crowd. There was an outdoor bazaar hawking lederhosen, mugs, and trinkets, and inside the hall the long tables were packed by tipsy folks scarfing down black beer and singing wonderlusting favorites. "Ach, Tip, you must try it," she said. "It's good luck, and this beer is famous, a love potion. On such a day, we don't have to sing, and no polkas. We can just drink a little and climb up to the crucifix." The love potion line worked, of course. Calling anything such does. Call even abominable herbal tea a love potion, and any idiot will swoon. The climb worked on me, too. We went straight up a staircase to heaven, and by the top I was breathless to lean on her. The prize at the peak was a life-size crucifix. Couples carrying discreet blankets were scattering into the woodline. That was not for me, never is. As a salesman, I obey all rules. I sat primly beside Frau Jodl. The far villages were orange-roofed matchboxes, darkening and brightening as cheery clouds passed over them. Agrarian Bavaria, if you haven't ever wanted to go there, makes picturesque an insult. I glanced into the nearby woods. It was too cool for them to undress. I thought, it must be comical, but whose style isn't? Frau Jodl was acting impatiently intimate. "Just put your arm around me, then." "Right." I distracted her with patter, then thought to ask what was most on my mind. Had she ever heard of Schweinfurt am Main's Tunnel of Love? She shrugged and shivered. "It's cold up here," she tried. I started to tell her why I cared about the Tunnel of Love. She wouldn't have it. "You know, Tip, no one cares about that time anymore. My papa doesn't care either. It was a long time ago. No one here today was born then." I asked if this meant it was a new Germany. She surprised me. "I don't care if it is or not. I was born here. I don't live here. Politics is, well, you know, you Americans, you already own everything. Why are you unhappy? You, my darling Tip, why are you unhappy? So free and rich. You remind me of someone I knew once. A terrorist. It's not funny. He's in jail now, forever, with his unhappiness. I don't think about Germany or any other country. In Africa, people are happy to eat once. Just once. For me, you work hard and make things happier wherever you are." Good speech, I thought. A kinder man would have shut up. Tip asked who the terrorist was. "He was a fascist," she snapped. "He tried to blow up a bank," she snapped. "He kidnapped two girls and killed one," she snapped. "What does it matter now? He was the people's hero one day, so he claimed, and the next he was telling the police crazy stories about everyone he knew. That's your fascist. Heartless, brainless, gangsters. Crazy, sick, crazy, crazy, crazy." I waited to see if there was more. Then I asked if the gangster had sold her out, too. Was that why she was in Africa? She leaned close. "You do make movies, don't you? I forgot a moment. You're not a terrorist. You're Hollywood." I said I was certainly guilty of Hollywood. She laughed. "No, no one sold me, Tip. Is that what you think? He sold only gangsters like himself. And now they're gone." She punched me and giggled. "Maybe they're in your tunnel. How's that?" We climbed down from Kreuzberg Rhone, better friends, that's certain. And while we raced off to the local resort of Bad Kissingen for more sights, I decided I was in love with her for today. She wasn't my style, true, but a good weave nonetheless, and she wore Bad Kissingen so well. It's a village like a Disneyland for world-weary adults. Bad Kissingen was once famous for its mineral baths, the old-fashioned version of a health club. Haydn, Bach, Mozart are still playing the local band shell. Beethoven must have stumbled upon it in his forays and fled its charms instantly for the woods, tripping over fellow curmudgeon Goethe. Everything you can dream up that is bucolic and civilized about Bavaria is replicated there. And there's a casino, too. Convinced? The gardens are splendid, the swans are ethereal, the shops are baubles, the hoteliers are midwives, the churches are Rococo apologia. As we strolled this paradise, my soul started to waver. I was thinking anti-Tip, treacherous notions such as John Calvin was a French... Well, you know. What was wrong with Popism was the Italians. Well, you know. America was lost over the edge of the flat earth. You know. Mine eyes have seen the glory, and it's Bavarian. You know. We supped on veal, and the meat weakened me the more, along with Liebfrau milk and Frau Jodl's affections. I hallucinated that I should quit common sense, propose happiness to this African angel, jettison 400 years of Puritanism, and seek the banns in a Catholic church. I even yanked wary Marcus Aurelius into this make-believe. He wrote, "Once dismiss the view you take, and you are out of danger. You have rounded the foreland, and all is calm. A tranquil sea, a tideless haven." So then, Tip, I thought, renounce your German bashing, your Bavarian entrail stirring. Sure, Hitler found a tideless haven in Bavaria and didn't exactly have to press gang his barbarous crew from the local farm boys. Sure, Bavaria was a home to Nazism like Leningrad to Bolshevism, Hollywood to Cokeism. But that's gone. No one young enough to copulate standing up was alive back then. I held on to my convenient counter-reformation as I held Frau Jodl's waist. "Do you gamble, too?" she asked, pointing the way to the casino. I made a joke about losing a coin toss in my proto-past. "I think you're a lucky man. Let's see." We tried my luck in the casino. The champagne tried my synapses. And then we tried each other again in a Baroque chapel of a hotel suite overlooking a small green. Trite consequences. Frau Jodl was another lullaby, but non-maternal for a moment. She was too much of a woman for me, yet I can fake it with the rest if I've convinced myself I'm being wickedly matter-of-fact. "You must sleep on your side, Liebkin," she instructed me as we settled down in goose feathers. "It's better for your heart and breathing." I thrashed around. There was more instruction. "Don't sleep naked. Ring the porter for a nightshirt. It's chilly in the morning." I grumbled and made a remark. "Think I need a nightcap?" She was brusque. "You can sleep any way you want to. I'm just thinking of your health. You don't wear enough clothes for the mountain air, and your muscles are knots from the way you hold yourself. At least, relax in your sleep." She was off to another medley of lullabies. I listened like a post-op patient. No nightshirt for me, but I did try to sleep on my side. This torture lasted until she slept. I'm too big to rest unless flat on my backside, like a corpse burdened with a soul. And then the bed attacked my spine. I confess I got even moodier. Also, I'd been dreaming badly since landfall in Germany, and Thursday night's Bavarian nightmare about Der Liebstunnel still harried me. By first light, I was fitfully visionary. I slipped out sideways, and she, a light sleeper like Clara Barton, instructed, "Drink some water. Don't smoke your pipe. Cover your shoulders. Sit by the window, and you'll soon come back to bed. I'm here." Many fine fellows I know would regard this sort of woman as a queen. She directed her energy right at me. She wasn't a shirker about the soul, either. For me, she was a threat alert. I escaped like Beethoven from blissful Bonaparte into the sitting room. I most enjoyed myself standing, smoking, uncovered, at the window. It was going to be another wunderbar day. The long first rays had reached the green below. There were no sounds but the hungry birds and a brook nearby. No color but the white-painted stones, and that hunter's green perfection that grass enjoys minutes before dawn. I was cranky enough to stare and stare as I puffed and puffed. My anti-tip mood was gone. I stood a naked Puritan and scowled. I was chasing the tunnel of love. What was it? I couldn't solve it. I needed help. So I called on a make-believe friend of mine, a completely vain alter ego whom I call Holmes Payne. More grandiosely, I fancied that the spirit of Sherlock Holmes was close by me. He had fallen into Reichenbach Falls, and I made believe his spirit had bubbled here to me at Bad Kissingen. So then, I was Puritan Holmes Payne, on the trail of something that I'd heard, seen, touched, or imagined this last week that must be, the answer to my investigation. The crime was notorious. You know it by Dr. Watson's title, The Case of the Third Reich. 40 years later, the crime was well exposed, the victims greatly mourned, the criminals condemned. Holmes Payne was tracking a cold trail for something Scotland Yard had missed, as if Lestrade had leaped to the obvious at the Nuremberg trials, nabbed all the correct devils, but in his righteous haste botched the trail. Netting the right gang, Lestrade had missed the mastermind. My intuition was that Moriarty, the anthropomorphized source of all evil, had slipped away again. I wanted to get him, it, whatever it was. When you have eliminated the impossible, the incomparable S. Holmes once preached to Dr. Watson, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. All right, Holmes Paine summarized obediently. The eliminated impossibles were that Marcus Aurelius didn't waste his time on the Danube trying to pacify the German barbarians, that those same barbarians didn't eventually pacify Rome forever, that, skipping 1,500 years of skull and bones and what horror the Reformation and its counter caused, Germany didn't rise up out of imperial dunderheadedness to try to pacify every country on both sides of it in the First World War, the Great War. That Hitler didn't happen after the Great War. And, I was being meticulous, that our 8th Air Force didn't pound Schweinfurt flat for nothing but ball bearings. Most of all, that the tunnel of love doesn't mean something. Those were all impossibles. I, Holmes Paine, tried to locate the improbable and lost the scent again. I called on Marcus Aurelius, more of his stress management. The one I like best is boilerplate for him and all of us Stoics. How's my soul's helmsman doing? This is everything. All else, within and beyond my control, is bones and vapors. There were some very fetching bones and vapors in the nearby bedroom, but to prove to you I am a low-slung bloodhound, I report that instead of quitting my nuttiness, I stayed with it. I stared down at the green. Perfectly civilized Bad Kissingen, perfectly pastoral Bavaria, perfectly charitable Frau Jodl. And then I saw what was right in front of me on the green below my window. The green was used for croquet, probably for the touring English. Who else plays that silly game? Someone had missed out collecting all the croquet wickets. I spied the forgotten wickets because the light was better and they were white. That's it. The improbable solution. Croquet wickets. All at once, I'd solved 2 millennia of Germany, our bombing runs on all those black weekdays in the past, and our armored cavalry deployment here, waiting for all those black weekdays in the future. Most especially, I'd solved the tunnel of love. I know this sounds crazy, that sleepy, moody tip could spot simple white croquet wickets on a trim Bavarian lawn and know that he'd solved the case. I'm reporting it as it happened and skipping how I'd done it. It was an improbable and far-fetched solution, yet it was the truth, and it all came down to the tunnel of love. I knew what Der Liebstunnel was, and why they hadn't cleaned it out, and what was in it. Gordon Liddy is my muse. In the tunnel of love. Black Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Holmes Paine on the case. Tip, the croquet player. A tale of the Cold War. 6. You want to know, and I'm going to tell you, but my way. This isn't fast food. I do that stuff in my screenplays. This is Tip, the wandering misanthrope. And I don't give a hoot if you leave off. You're a badly read citizen if you do. And I wouldn't spend 4 minutes trapped in a first-class compartment with your excellent shoes, hired aroma, healthy aversions. It's sharp-eyed readers I want along with me now, because this is a fussy, bookish case before the bar of history. I gave you a sneaky hint earlier when I said I dressed like a croquet player, whites on whites, pastel tie. This was a falsehood. I actually dressed the baggy Yankee jurist at the florist's. Chit-chat and blue wool over the anemones. I only wear white when someone's wed or the opera is unavoidably ridiculous. Tip the jurist now refers you to the common law grandfather of us sci-fi spy boys, H.G. Wells, who outraged every Victorian but Mark Twain and Bernard Shaw. You know Wells is a shop-worn scrivener, Boom Boom H.G., with his Martians, air wars, atomic bomb, knee-jerk Darwinism, and that nonpareil time machine. However, Wells, after the First War, had softened his mind, and then the 1920s had hardened it again, bashing Fordized America, the Anglican Church, Whitehall the insufferable, and Winston the inedible. And after all that, Wells got prophetic again in the 1930s, the age of the despots and their flacks right and left. Wells only flacked for Wells, and in 1936, in his insatiably bitter 70s, he published a novella that is the scariest little book I've ever read after Job. It's entitled The Croquet. It's entitled The Croquet Player. The unnamed narrator is vacationing on the French coast with his noble aunt, the suffragette Peacenik. He is a professional croquet player. The one thing he cares to do well in a silly world, hit a round ball with a flat mallet, through wickets on trim grass, and only when it's clement. The croquet player thinks his dear aunt, sweat-minded with her causes for disarmament, one-worldism, peace at last. At luncheon one day, the croquet player chances to converse with an intense Englishman, who, though on holiday too, seems strangely candid. All English feign eccentricity. This one, the croquet player thinks, promotes his centeredness. And he has a story to tell. The Englishman says that he has come from a wet rural reach of Britain, where the local parsonage was the best supper table in walking distance. The parson was gentlemanly, none of that Methodist love or dissenter scolding. The parson's wife was loving and reasonable cook. The parson's one love was mankind, and his hobbies were walks with God Almighty and local lore. Slowly, however, the Englishman heard tell at the table over many weeks that the best people in the village were becoming homicidal. Wives were stabbed, children vanished, clerks turned shotguns on other clerks. The parson was baffled by this mayhem. No one had ever come to service, yet he had always known they were too busy being good Christians out there. The new deviltry was a puzzle. The parson wrote the bishop for instruction. One other factor emerged to the Englishman at the parson's table. There was a local famous bog, bottomless and grim as it should be, and recently some local boys had dared close enough to discover bones had bubbled up from its maw. These bones had come to the parson's attention, and he was pleased when he ascertained by correspondence that the British Museum was interested. They were Neanderthal bones, evidence that this sublimely wretched neighborhood had always been a thriving settlement. The Englishman finished his tale to the croquet player morbidly. The parson's wife became adulterous with the bishop. The parson murdered her in a passionate rage. The Englishman, deprived of his table, planned to move on. But first he swung by the bog at dusk. What he saw terrified him. He watched as vapors rose up from the bubbling bones and formed the image of a gigantic skull, mouth open, the rising of a death's head. The unflappable croquet player was flapped by the Englishman's tale. He arrived at luncheon the next day, hoping to learn more of this bog. The Englishman didn't appear. Inquiries were made. Indisposed? Departed? The answer arrived from a local doctor at another table. The Englishman was his patient at the sanitarium, and, to the doctor's certainty, the Englishman had been here many years, was very mad, but not dangerous, and hadn't been out of the care of doctors since he was a lad. The croquet player faced the truth. Everything he had heard was make-believe, wasn't it? Wells wrote the croquet player just as the Hitlerites were rising up out of the bogs of Bavaria. It wasn't some idle romance to him. He knew that what was happening in bucolic Germany was coming fair England's way. Wells was scared, and he meant to frighten the countrymen and women to action. The message was, it can happen here. You will remember that his message failed. Wells wrote a good book that told the truth and make-believe, and very few listened. Mass murder followed. Fast forward to Tip. That Bavarian morning, watching the sun light up the croquet's wickets on the green, I was scared too. Soon enough, I mean to frighten you about the tunnel of love. Frau Jodl did get me back to bed that morning. There were more happy commands and obligations. We breakfasted easily, attended Mass for my curiosity, drove back down to Schweinfurt most satisfied, and I kept shut throughout about my discovery. Bunyan was returned in all his American glory. I was proud to introduce him and noted Frau Jodl's smile at his size and earnest politeness. I had bragged to her that there were tens of thousands more like him back in greedy America. Bunyan's such a treat to spring upon European prejudice. "You're the little brother," she said. I corrected, "baby brother." She laughed. "How? What do they feed you?" Bunyan shook her hand. "Nice to meet you, ma'am," he said. Then in German, "It's a pleasure, Frau Jodl." We invited her to luncheon at the officers' club. Frau Jodl declined, saying she was best back to Nuremberg. I kissed her farewell at the car, and she kissed back. "When you get to Africa, find me through the Red Cross," she said. "It'll be fun there, too, and I can show you, Tip, what happiness is, true happiness." The German is die Freude, or joy, and it was part of her wardrobe. She was a splendid adventuress. I missed her immediately and then put her in my pantheon, while Bunyan and I drove to the officers' club. Bunyan told tales en route and sweetly blushed re Frau Jodl. "She's nice, huh?" he remarked. "A nurse, too." I told tales and did not blush. After luncheon, we strolled out into the brigade HQ grounds to provide me a close look at the war machines, and also at this end of the tunnel of love. The well-armed sentries saluted Bunyan correctly. I liked how keen they were, faced by my baby brother, who was a princely centurion and takes the army, his duty, and our country very seriously. I was the frail child here. He was the grown-up. Nearby, there was one M1 Abrams blockbuster tank out of its cage, being brushed and pampered by its crew. When you first stand next to a main battle tank, you will know that war is crazy work. What else but craziness could make human beings build, man, and attack with such a monster, could make other human beings try to get in its way? It's a ground eater. They keep rubber mufflers on the tank treads when using the paved roads. Bunyan explained that when they wound up its jet engine, it screamed. "They get speeding tickets," Bunyan joked. "When they open it up on rubber treads, it can clock 90 clicks, and the MPs don't like that. Scares the heck out of the cows." "Brave cows," I said. "Would do worse than that to me." "Imagine this one microchip brain creature coming at you at speed. Then consider that it knows where you are and can swat you like a pest without stopping. Then imagine a company of them, a division's worth, covered above by our Black Hawk helicopters, which are simply octane dragons. I can see from one tank why the war planners fancy themselves medievalists. The ages are dark. Chivalry is losing to witchcraft. Every field is a joust. Every contender sports treads. Everybody dies." The other armored knights were parked behind a meaningless cyclone fence. Bunyan explained that when they sound a practice scramble, the tank crews bat out of hell from their mortality to get to their creatures before they move, because they don't wait. The tank platoons fan outward through the fence and into the woods. 5 minutes, Bunyan explained, this place is empty. They give the rest of us 10 minutes to find our transport. After that, you're a casualty. I didn't make it once and never again. It's bad news. I asked Bunyan if he'd been up to the no man's land on the border. "Sure," he said, "but just for a look-see. And it's not called no man's land. It's the frontier of freedom." "Correction acknowledged," I obeyed. "They camped them 3 weeks out of 4 up there," said Bunyan. "It's tough on them. Tougher on their wives and kids. They're mostly 19 years old. First time away from home. Brutal. The divorce rate is brutal. Up on the border, they play chicken in the rain with the hostiles, and they're loading live rounds when they do." It was time to try out my solution of the case. First, I asked Bunyan if that chicken game on the border was entertainment. "You guys are bugging out when it comes, right?" "Affirmative," he said. "The guys caught up on the border are KIA. We've got assembly areas to get to. Then we do what we're told." I asked my last question before I, doing the croquet player's work, was absolutely Holmes Payne certain. "Where's the entrance to the Tunnel of Love?" Bunyan wasn't sure. He waved out to the former airfield where our tanks now awaited Armageddon. "They sealed it up," he said. "Must be there somewhere, because it runs that way." He pointed east toward the old Panzer Regiment barracks and that swastika eagle. He sensed I was up to something foolish. He asked, "Why?" I told Bunyan, "Now I tell you, der Liebestunnel is a bog of Bavaria. There must be others. I know where this one is, and we'll mark it on your map, the way it is targeted on our fire coordinate grid design. Bunyan's armored cavalry isn't at Schweinfurt to fight the Russians, nor is our black horse there as defenders of Germany. They are occupiers. We and the Russians are allied occupiers. The 40-year-old Cold War has blinded me to the original challenge when the Allies move in. Our children are part of the army of occupation, and the Brits, Belgians, Italians are too. The French dropped out, and good Gallic riddance. And so are the Russians over the border, squatting with their T-80 weight on Prussia. World War III is coming on German soil, that's correct. But we and the Reds aren't going to be fighting to protect Germany. We're going to be fighting what's inside Germany itself. That's where the bogs of blackness are. Marcus Aurelius knew it. We and the Russians know it. Germany is Europe's blackness. Don't fuss at me. You want to forgive and forget? You're a saint. I'm not. Don't give me that Germany, the nation of the enlightened geniuses argument, citing Mozart, Beethoven, Mahler, Goethe, Heine, Rilke, and Mann. You know you get the very highs with the very lows. And don't try that banality of evil palaver on me. Evil is a monster, and it's cunning, immortal, long-brooding. Lastly, I'm not listening to most of them weren't born then brief, because a shrewd ancient source assures me that wickedness is visited upon the sons until the third and fourth generation, and 40 years is merely one passing generation. Every land must have its bog of blackness. I agree. But Germany has what law enforcement calls a long list of priors. What's down inside the tunnel of love is Black Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And what's keeping the blackness penned up is our armored cavalry on guard over the exits. This is why they never could clean it up. You can't extinguish evil. That's theological absurdity. It's what our 8th Air Force was really after in those desperate raids at Schweinfurt, back 40 years of black days. Curtis LeMay and our bombing children were not wrong-headed after all. They were on target and brave beyond the rational. It's also why that single swastika eagle remains on a pillar at Schweinfurt. It's a marker buoy for our bomb and gun sights. It's also why the Germans don't like our army boys and girls, and why the German boys are such crummy soldiers these days. We keep them crummy. We're a combat boot on their shoddy intrinsic values, and as long as the money and luck hold, we're not letting them get back up again. The tunnel of love is fleshless, vaporous Third Reich. It's loving itself and breeding down there. If you're not scared by this, then I guess you're one of those who say it can't happen here again. I offer comfort to those who know it can. Bunyan and his compatriots have got it trapped shut from both ends for now. However, I am stoic enough to know that good and bad come in cycles. Nothing is lost, especially not blackness. When it comes out of the tunnel again, the blackness will have another novel jingoistic name, but it will be a familiar to Marcus Aurelius. When it comes up again, our armored cavalry is bugging out, and our brass is calling down all the ordnance in our locker. God help us all if it's not enough. How's my soul's helmsman doing? Marcus Aurelius asked once upon a hellish time in the German quagmire. This is everything, said Marcus Aurelius. All else, within and beyond my control, is bones and vapor. I answer, Marcus Aurelius. Our soul's helmsman is doing just fine, sir, patrolling the blackness, the black, black bones and vapors. Before I found the tunnel of love, I worried that the good guys might be overlooking some rotten threat. At least now I know, as the good guys do, where some worst of those bones are waiting, and that vapor is wafting. Brave Bunyan faced that gigantic death's head, Der Totenkopf, every dusk. We croquet players out here in the land of the free have our job, too. We are folly itself, hit a round ball with a flat mallet head on a trim lawn, and only when it's clement. It's a silly world, and let's keep it that way as long as possible. I'm a well-paid fool. What did Bunyan make of my solution? He giggled, and I loved him for that giggle. We looked for a movie, but he'd seen Eddie Murphy already, and the rest of the local offerings looked anti-American to me. So we rented his favorite VCR tape that summer, The Terminator, featuring a southern Bavarian as the evil that won't quit until it's crushed by American machines. Bunyan's laughter at the movie made me relax, and I trust it relaxes Marcus Aurelius' soul, too. Our best children are still on station, Roman wise man, and our Pax Americana has a few more good years
until our glory goes fleeting too. The end.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.